Make It Right, the manufacturing podcast.
Welcome to the Make It Right podcast. I'm Janet Eastman. This week, it's part two of my conversation with Greg Thomas, who in his role as managing director at 375 Park Associates has helped U.S. companies significantly reduce their costs and increase their profits when they enter into the Asian market. Last week, we talked about some of the options manufacturers can use to improve and grow their businesses when huge capital investment is not an option. We pick up the conversation discussing the benefits of co-location.
This actually works more in project-based type manufacturing circumstances, or works better in project-based manufacturing circumstances. And I'll give you an example. Here is a shipyard that we worked with in Italy. And what they did there is they partnered with their suppliers to actually bring everything on site when they had a build. And now we're talking about not just a 10 or 20 foot boats. These were, you know, 100 foot or 150 foot luxury yachts. And there what they do is they manage it like you do a construction project. Basically, some of the stuff is made off site, but most of it is going to be brought on site, produced at the same time, and then assembled. And in that way, you can co-locate and get everybody at the same approximate location at the same time for a build. Another example of it, though, and it's not just here, it could also be, look at automotive, where the automotive industry is very much one that needs a cluster of certain supplier relationships to function correctly. The perfect example is the Detroit, Hamilton, Ontario, right? And that cluster around there, and how many times cars go back and forth over the border. Another example would be electronics, and the Taiwanese were in some ways one of the first to kind of recognize this with their cluster approach to manufacturing. And these are all examples of co-location, and it's a great way to leverage suppliers or partners' capabilities, you know, especially when they're close to you. So you've only got a 20-minute transit time. Granted, it's not ideal, but it's cheaper than you might have the technology you need without you actually having to pay for it and bring it into your own factory.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a fourth option called revenue sharing. How does that work?
Well, I'll give you an example here. We've got an industrial client in the U.S., and they've actually become one of three metal fabricators in the U.S. to add a state-of-the-art hydraulic leveling machine. And the way they did this is they were able to bring it inside without actually breaking the bank. And they struck a deal with the vendor for this machine, which said, look, we'll pay a certain base for the machine, but it's new. It's only one of three in the U.S. If we use it more than X amount, we'll pay you something incremental up to a ceiling on it, and that will actually cut the back end off the financing for this. And that was one way that they worked to kind of to finance this, get it at a level where they could afford it, and at the same time be one of the first people in the U.S. with this capability.
Okay, so that's an interesting concept. And are vendors actually offering those favorable terms, payment solutions, etc., for equipment purchases?
It depends. You know, the larger vendors are coming to appreciate the need to offer more robust payment solutions. But to be honest with you, many others are still trapped in the old way of doing things. You know, this is ironic since industrial automation and IIoT are all about disruption. You know, the way I would look at it is say, what can be done? And I think where competition exists, boards must look at all of the available options. In these situations, even where a vendor has only option on the market, then they need to look at the strategic need or fit, and that must be answered before going forward. You know, in some situations, they might even need to rob Peter to pay Paul, internally. But if they can leverage competition and do that trade-off, analysis, they might find that one vendor might not have everything that they want and need, but it's going to have most of what they want and need for most of their jobs. And they're going to offer a payment solution that's going to be more flexible than what somebody else is going to have. And that might be the best way to go forward.
Yeah. So are these approaches like machines as a service, co-locationing, et cetera, are these practices being used in other countries? Like, are they factories in North America doing this, or is it mostly just over in Asia?
Actually, what I would say is it's mostly being driven. Some of the examples I gave were in Asia because it's where I've done a lot of work over the last 15 years or so. A lot of where this innovation is coming from is actually in the West. And it's happening in a number of industries. I'll give you an example. Construction, as we talked about briefly earlier, also oil and gas. And in some cases, as I said, it's also the getting the trick right where machines can roll in or roll off, a production floor or manufacturing floor. In terms of co-locating, it already exists. And I gave you the example earlier about the automotive industry. And also in project-based builds, which is, even in the U.S., you see it to a certain extent, especially on the assembly side, what Boeing did with their Dreamliner project. But you also see it in builds for boats for the Navy and so on. The big thing for me, and this is even going back to my consulting days, and it was where I think Lean often was. Kind of abused, is that you co-locating in some ways becomes a balance sheet mechanism where basically you're keeping stuff at your suppliers or loading dock. It's still on their balance sheet and you're only getting it when exactly you need it, and you're using that and you're converting that inventory at that moment, so it's a mechanism more to keep your inventory down than to offer a real improvement. My hope is that that's starting to change, but I think it's still very much a work in process.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens if a company actually decides to do nothing? Like, this isn't an option. It's like you said earlier in the conversation, factories are not operating the way they were 150 years ago because they couldn't compete. So, I mean, you don't have the money, you know, what do you do if it seems like there isn't any options for you?
That's a good question. And I guess you're right to bring up what I said a few minutes earlier. You know, I would counter that there are some times when boards are rewarded for standing pat, for not doing anything. But we need to keep in mind, the state of the steel industry in the US, is they basically did nothing in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. while the rest of the world was forced to rebuild their mills using newer, better equipment and processes. I think what it comes back onto is that we're in manufacturing, we're in the midst of an arms race. And the moral of this is that to the winner go the spoils. So to answer the second part of your question, you don't have the money. What do you do?
Yeah.
That's when you've really got to sit down, break down the process, find ways to get creative. If you can't do it in-house, is there a supplier or a vendor that you can work with? Can you do it via joint venture? Are there other options that you can do that could get you over the goal line?
I have one final question for you. I might throw you a curveball here, but on the road to making America great again and bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., et cetera, are any of these options being used to do that right now?
I think all of them are.
Okay.
We've got to be mindful. We've got to separate the rhetoric from the reality, right?
Right. And
the reality is that the U.S. is still one of the largest, if not the largest, manufacturing economy in the world. The days I grew up in upstate New York, in Syracuse, there are Chrysler, General Motors, General Electric, Carrier. These were all big companies with big factories, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 employees. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you saw it in Canada as well. Those days are largely gone. So yes, we still have a lot of manufacturing activity, but the number of people we need to output the same amount is reduced dramatically. In fact, that's the only way that onshoring or the reshoring of manufacturing is going to work. In the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, it was about low-cost manufacturing, right? Moving stuff to Asia and then shipping it back. But slowly we're coming to the realization, and I think it's a combination of technology catching up as well, but we're coming to the realization that doing that isn't good. We're losing some of the capability to build things. And at the same time, we're now gaining the capability where we don't, you know, through technology, where we don't need as many people at the same, you know, rates of labor contribution that we did 20 or 30 years ago. Probably a better question is, what does this mean for, say, the average guy on the shop floor, on the factory floor? And we're going through the same sort of thing that we probably saw in the 19th century when people left the farm and now, you know, went into the factory. And there's going to be a constant need for upskilling. So make America great again, bring back, or Canada make great again, or any country great again, bringing back or keeping manufacturing. I think some of that is naturally going to happen. The days of shipping stuff around the world, then deliver it, sure, it'll stay for some industries or low-cost commodity-type products. But for others, which are high-cost or have a, you know, where inventory, managing inventory is an issue, moving to, you know, manufacturing near the market where you sell it is, I think, is going to become the norm. And in that case, the only way you can really do it and maintain control of cost in the long run is by looking at how you can automate process.
Right. That's one of the things that I've been really curious about too, Greg, is like, you know, you have components, you ship them to Asia, they do something to them, then you ship them back to North America, and then they're shipped somewhere else, and they're shipped and shipped and shipped. What happens when the cost of shipping gets so high that that isn't going to be possible? And you just said it, you know, you're going to have to go back to the way it used to be, where you had to build things close to the location where you're going to sell them because your transportation costs were going to just be too high.
Well, and in some industries you have that, in other industries you don't. I mean, iPhones today are still largely made, you know, in China, and they're taking components from all around the world, and then they're coming to China to be assembled. Though there are components coming from China as well. And you know, it's ironic because let's say in that supply chain, you're taking rare earth minerals from China, shipping them to Germany or the U.S. or Canada or elsewhere, make the component parts, then shipping them back to China for assembly. You know, it's an intricate web. I think ultimately for manufacturers or for companies as a whole, it's a question of whether that makes sense for them. And part of it is going to be the cost of shipping. I think another part, though, and it can't be underlooked, is the cost of managing that inventory while it's in shipping. If we go back to lead in some of the waste, I mean, one of the wastes is transport time, right? And that can be even worse than the cost to actually move it from A to B, because it's on somebody's books for that period of time. And while it's inventory, they're not able to convert that easily into cash. And that's where I think the real kind of loss is.
Greg, interesting conversation. Thank you so much for your time today. I have a million more questions for you, but we'll have to leave it there. I really appreciate talking to you today.
Thank you, Janet.
Greg Thomas is the managing director at 375 Park Associates. They're a strategic growth advisory firm that helps private equity firms investing in middle market companies overcome challenges in their portfolio. That is the Make It Right podcast for this week. I'm Janet Eastman. Thanks very much for listening, and do share the podcast with your friends.